Mary. I saved you the best loaf of the night.
Eh, bâtard,
Joseph says. I am impressed. Most people don't know the French term for that shape. Do you know why it's called that? I say, as I cut a few slices, trying hard not to think of Mary and her dream. Because it's not a boule and it's not a baguette. Literally, it's a bastard.
Who knew that even in the world of baking there is a class structure?
Joseph muses. I know it's a good loaf. You can smell it when an artisanal bread comes out of the oven, the earthy, dark scent, as if you are in the thick of the woods. I glance with pride at the variegated crumb. Joseph closes his eyes in delight.
I am lucky to know the baker personally.
Speaking of that, you umpired the Little League game of a friend's son, Brian Lancaster? He frowns, shaking his head.
It was years ago. I did not know all their names.
We chat. About the weather, about Eva, about my favorite recipes. We chat as Mary closes up the bakery around us, after hugging me fiercely and telling me that not only does God love me, but she does, too. We chat, even as I dart back and forth into the kitchen to answer the calls of various timers. This is extraordinary for me, because I don't chat. There are even moments during our conversations when I forget to disguise the pitted side of my face by ducking my head or letting my hair fall in front of it. But Joseph, he is either too polite or too embarrassed to mention it. Or maybe, just maybe, there are other things about me he finds more interesting. This is what must have made him everyone's favorite teacher, umpire, adoptive grandfather. He acts as if there is nowhere else on earth he'd rather be than here, right now. And no one else on earth he'd rather be talking to. It is such a heady rush to be the object of someone's attention in a good way, not as freak, that I keep forgetting to hide. How long have you lived here? I ask, when we have been talking for over an hour.
22 years, Joseph says. I used to live in Canada.
Well, if you were looking for a community where nothing ever happens, you hit the jackpot. Joseph smiles.
I think so.
Do you have family around here? His hand shakes as he reaches for his mug of coffee.
I have no one,
Joseph answers. And he starts to get to his feet.
I must go.
Immediately my stomach turns over because I've made him uncomfortable, and nobody knows better than I do what that feels like. I'm sorry, I blurt out. I didn't mean to be rude. I don't talk to many people. I offer him an unhemmed smile and make amends the only way I know how, by revealing a piece of myself that I usually keep under lock and key so that I am equally exposed. I also have no one, I confess. I'm 25, and both my parents are dead. They won't see me get married. I won't get to cook them Thanksgiving dinner or visit them with grandkids. My sisters are totally different from me. They have minivans and soccer practices and careers with bonuses, and they hate me even though they say they don't. The words are a flood rushing out of me. Just speaking them, I am drowning. But mostly I have no one because of this. With a shaking hand, I pull my hair back from my face. I know every detail he's seeing. The pocked drawstring of skin flapping the corner of my left eye, the silver hatch marks cutting through my eyebrow, the puzzle piece patchwork of grafted skin that doesn't quite match and doesn't quite fit, the way my mouth tugs upward because of how my cheekbone healed, the bald notch at my scalp that no longer grows hair that my bangs are brushed to carefully cover. The face of a monster. I cannot justify why I've picked Joseph, a virtual stranger, to reveal myself to. Maybe because loneliness is a mirror and recognizes itself. My hand falls away, letting the curtain of my hair cover my scars again. I just wish it were that easy to camouflage the ones inside me. To his credit, Joseph does not gasp or recoil. Steadily, he meets my gaze.
"Maybe now," he replies, "we will have each other."
The next morning, on my way home from work, I drive by Adam's house. I park on the street, roll down my window, and stare at the soccer net stretched across the front yard, at the welcome mat, at the lime-green bike tipped over and sunning itself in the driveway. I imagine what it would be like to sit at the dining room table, to have Adam toss the salad as I serve the pasta. I wonder if the walls in the kitchen are yellow or white. If there is still a loaf of bread, probably store-bought, I think with mild judgment, sitting on the counter after someone has made French toast for breakfast. When the door opens, I swear out loud and slink lower in my seat, even though there is no reason to believe that Shannon sees me. She comes out of the house still zipping her coat, hitting the remote control so that her car doors unlock. "Come on," she calls. "We're going to be late for the appointment." A moment later, Grace stumbles out, coughing violently. "Cover your mouth," her mother says. I realize I am holding my breath. Grace looks like Shannon, in miniature. Same golden hair, same delicate features, even the same bounce to their walk.
"Do I have to miss camp?"
Grace asks miserably.
"You do if you have bronchitis," Shannon says.
And then they both get into the car and peel out of the driveway. Adam hadn't told me his daughter was sick. Then again, why would he? I don't hold claim to that part of his life. As I pull away, I realize that I'm not going to book those airline tickets to Kansas City. I never will. Instead of driving home, though, I find myself looking up Joseph's address on my iPhone. He lives at the end of a small cul-de-sac, and I am parked at the curb trying to concoct a reason that I might be dropping by when he knocks on the window of my car.
"So it is you," Joseph says.
He is holding the end of Eva's leash. She dances around his feet in circles.
"What brings you to my neighborhood?"
he asks. I consider telling him that it is a coincidence, that I took a wrong turn, or that I have a friend who lives nearby. But instead, I wind up speaking the truth. "You," I say. A smile breaks across his face.
"Then you must stay for tea," he insists.
His home is not decorated the way I would have expected. There are chintz couches with lace doilies on the backs, photographs on top of a dusty mantel, a collection of Hummel figurines on a shelf. The invisible fingerprints of a woman are everywhere.
"You're married," I murmur.
"I was," Joseph says, "to Marta, for 51 very good years and 1 not so good."
This must have been the reason he started coming to grief group, I realize. "I'm sorry."
"I am, too," he says heavily.
He takes the tea bag from his mug and carefully wraps a noose around it on the bowl of the spoon.
"Every Wednesday night she would remind me to take the garbage can to the curb. In 50 years I never once forgot, but she never gave me the benefit of the doubt, drove me crazy. Now I would give anything to hear her remind me again."
"I almost flunked out of college," I reply. "My mother actually moved into my dorm room and dragged me out of bed and made me study with her. I felt like the biggest loser on earth. And now I realize how lucky I was." I reach down and stroke Eva's silky head. "Joseph," I ask, "do you ever feel like you're losing her? Like you can't hear the exact pitch of her voice in your head anymore? Or you can't remember what her perfume smelled like?" He shakes his head.
"I have the opposite problem," he says. "I can't forget him. Him?
Her,
Joseph corrects. All this time, and I still mix up the German words with the English. My gaze lands on a chess set on a sideboard behind Joseph. The pieces are all carefully carved, pawns shaped like tiny unicorns, rooks fashioned into centaurs, a pair of Pegasus knights. The queen's mermaid tail curls around its base. The head of the vampire king is tossed back, fangs bared. This is incredible, I breathe, walking closer for a better look. I've never seen anything like it. Joseph chuckles.
That is because there is only one. It is a family heirloom.
I stare with even more admiration at the chessboard, with its seamless inlay of cherry and maple squares, at the tiny jeweled eyes of the mermaid. It's beautiful.
Yes. My brother was very artistic, Joseph says softly.
He made this? I pick up the vampire and run my finger over the smooth, slick skull of the creature. Do you play? I ask.
Not for years. Marta had no patience for the game.
He looks up.
And you?
I'm not very good. You have to think 5 steps ahead.
It's all about strategy, Joseph says, and protecting your king.
What's with the mythical creatures? I ask.
My brother believed in all sorts of mythical creatures. Pixies, dragons, werewolves, honest men.
I find myself thinking of Adam, of his daughter, coughing as a pediatrician listens to her lungs. Maybe, I say, you could teach me what you know. Joseph becomes a regular at our daily bread, showing up shortly before closing so that we can spend a half hour chatting before he leaves for the night and I start my workday. When Joseph shows up, Rocco yells to me in the kitchen, referring to him as my boyfriend. Mary brings him a cutting from the shrine, daylily, and tells him how to plant it in his backyard. She starts assuming that even after she locks up, I will make sure Joseph gets home. The dog biscuits I bake for Eva become a new staple of our menu. We talk about teachers that I had at the high school when Joseph was still working there. Mr. Muchnick, whose toupee once went missing when he fell asleep proctoring an SAT test. Ms. Fierro, who would bring her toddler to school when her nanny got sick and would stick him in the computer lab to play Sesame Street games. We talk about a strudel recipe that his grandmother used to make. He tells me about Eva's predecessor, a schnauzer named Willie, who used to mummify himself in toilet paper if you left the bathroom door open by accident. Joseph admits that it is hard to fill all the hours he has, now that he isn't working or volunteering regularly. And me. I find myself talking about things that I have long packed up, like a spinster's hope chest. I tell Joseph about the time my mother and I went shopping together, and she got stuck in a sundress too small for her, and we had to buy it just so that we could rip it off. I tell him how, for years after that, even uttering the word sundress made us both collapse with laughter. I tell him how my father would read the Seder every year in a Donald Duck voice, not out of irreverence, but because it made his little girls laugh. I tell him how, on our birthdays, my mother let us eat our favorite dessert for breakfast, and how she could touch your forehead if you were feverish and guess your temperature within 0.2 degrees. I tell him how, when I was little and convinced a monster lived in my closet, my father slept for a month sitting upright against the slatted pocket doors so that the beast couldn't break out in the middle of the night. I tell him how my mother taught me to make hospital corners on a bed, how my father taught me to spit a watermelon seed through my teeth. Each memory is like a paper flower stowed up a magician's sleeve. Invisible one moment, and then so substantial and florid the next, I cannot imagine how it stayed hidden all this time. And like those paper flowers, once they've been let loose in the world, the memories are impossible to tuck away again. I find myself canceling dates with Adam so that I can instead spend an hour at Joseph's house, playing chess, before my eyelids droop and I have to drive back home and get some rest.
He teaches me to control the center of the board, to not give up any pieces unless absolutely necessary, and how to assign arbitrary point values to each knight and bishop and rook and pawn so that I can make those decisions. As we play, Joseph asks me questions. Was my mother a redhead, like me? Did my father ever miss the restaurant industry once he went into industrial sales? Did either of them ever get a chance to taste some of my recipes? Even the answers that are hardest to give, like the fact that I never baked for either of them, don't burn my tongue as badly as they would have a year or 2 years ago. It turns out that sharing a memory with someone is different from reliving it when you're alone. It feels less like a wound, more like a poultice. 2 weeks later, Joseph and I carpool to our next grief group meeting. We sit beside each other, and it is as if we have a subtle telepathy between us as the other group members speak. Sometimes he catches my gaze and hides a smile. Sometimes I roll my eyes at him. We are suddenly partners in crime. Today we are talking about what happens to us after we die. Do we stick around? Marge asks. Watch over our loved ones? I think so. I can still feel Sheila sometimes, Stuart says. It's like the air gets more humid. Well, I think it's pretty self-serving to think that souls hang around with the rest of us, Shayla says immediately. They go to heaven. Everyone? Everyone who's a believer, she qualifies. Shayla is born again. This isn't a surprise, but it still makes me uncomfortable, as if she is specifically talking about my ineligibility. When my mother was in the hospital, I say, her rabbi told her a story. In heaven and hell, people sit at banquet tables filled with amazing food, but no one can bend their elbows. In hell, everyone starves because they can't feed themselves. In heaven, everyone's stuffed because they don't have to bend their arms to feed each other. I can feel Joseph staring at me. Mr. Weber? Marge prompts. I assume Joseph will ignore her question or shake his head like usual. But to my surprise, he speaks.
When you die, you die. And everything is over.
His blunt words settle like a shroud over the rest of us.
Excuse me, he says,
and he walks out of the meeting room. I find him waiting in the hallway of the church.
That story you told about the banquet, Joseph says. Do you believe it?
I guess I'd like to, I say, for my mother's sake.
But your rabbi?
Not my rabbi, my mother's. I start walking toward the door.
But you believe in an afterlife?
Joseph says, curious. And you don't?
I believe in hell, but it's here on earth.
He shakes his head.
Good people and bad people. As if it were this easy. Everyone is both of these at once.
Don't you think one outweighs the other? Joseph stops walking.
You tell me,
he says. As if his words have heat behind them, my scar burns. How come you've never asked me, I blurt out, how it happened?
How what happened?
I make a circular gesture in front of my face.
Ach, well, a long time ago someone once told me that a story will tell itself when it's ready. I assumed that it wasn't ready.
It is a strange idea that what happened to me isn't my tale to tell, but something completely separate from me. I wonder if this has been my problem all along, not being able to dissect the two. I was in a car accident, I say. Joseph nods, waiting. I wasn't the only one hurt. I manage, although the words choke me.
But you survived.
Gently, he touches my shoulder.
Maybe that's all that matters,
I shake my head. I wish I could believe that. Joseph looks at me.
Don't we all?
He says. The next day, Joseph doesn't come to the bakery. He doesn't come the following day either. I have come to the only viable conclusion. Joseph is lying comatose in his bed. Or worse. In all the years I've worked at Our Daily Bread, I've never left the bakery unattended overnight. My evenings are ordered to military precision, with me working a mile a minute to divide dough and shape it into hundreds of loaves, to have them proofed and ready for baking when the oven is free. The bakery itself becomes a living, breathing thing, each station a new partner to dance with. Mess up on the timing, and you will find yourself standing alone while chaos whirls around you. I find myself compensating in a frenzy, trying to produce the same amount of product in less time. But I realize that I'm not going to be of any use until I go to Joseph's house and make sure he's still breathing. I drive there and see a light on in the kitchen. Immediately, Eva starts barking. Joseph opens the front door.
Sage, he says, surprised.
He sneezes violently and wipes his nose with a white cloth handkerchief.
Is everything all right?
You have a cold, I say, the obvious.
Did you come all this way to tell me what I already know?
No, I thought... I mean, I wanted to check on you, since I hadn't seen you in a few days.
Ach, well, as you can see, I am still standing.
He gestures.
You will come in?
I can't, I say. I have to get back to work. But I make no move to leave. I was worried when you didn't show up at the bakery. He hesitates, his hand on the doorknob.
So, you came to make sure I was alive?
I came to check on a friend.
Friends? Joseph repeats, beaming. We are friends now?
A 25-year-old disfigured girl and a nonagenarian? I suppose there have been stranger duos.
I would like that very much, Joseph says formally. I will see you tomorrow, Sage. Now you must go back to work so that I can have a roll with my coffee.
20 minutes later, I am back in the kitchen, turning off a half a dozen angry timers and assessing the damage caused by my hour AWOL. There are loaves that have proofed too much. The dough has lost its shape and sags to one side or the other. My output for the whole night will be affected. Mary will be devastated. Tomorrow's customers will leave empty-handed. I burst into tears. I'm not sure if I'm crying because of the disaster in the kitchen or because I didn't realize how upsetting it was to think that Joseph might be taken away from me when I've only just found him. I just don't know how much more I can stand to lose. I wish I could bake for my mother. Boules and pain au chocolat and brioche piled high on her table in heaven. I wish I could be the one to feed her, but I can't. It's like Joseph said, no matter what we survivors like to tell ourselves about the afterlife, when someone dies, everything is over. But this, I look around the bakery kitchen. This I can reclaim by working the dough very briefly and letting it rise again. So I need. The next day, a miracle occurs. Mary, who at first is tight-lipped and angry at my reduced nightly output, slices open a ciabatta.
What am I supposed to do, Sage?
She sighs. Tell customers to just go down the street to Rudy's? Rudy's is our competition.
You could give them a rain check?
Peanut butter and jelly tastes like crap on a rain check.
When she asks what happened, I lie. I tell her that I got a migraine and fell asleep for 2 hours. It won't happen again. Mary purses her lips, which tells me that she hasn't forgiven me yet. Then she picks up a slice of the bread, ready to spread it with strawberry jam. Except she doesn't.
"Jesus, Mary, and Joseph!"
she gasps, dropping the slice as if it's burned her fingers. She points to the crumb. That's a fancy term for the holes inside bread. Artisanal bread is judged on its variegated crumb. Other breads, like Wonder, which is barely even a bread nutritionally, have uniform tiny crumb.
"Do you see him?"
If I squint, I can make out what looks like the shape of a face. Then it becomes more clear. A beard. A thorny crown. Apparently, I've baked the face of God into my loaf. The first visitors to our little miracle are the women who work in the shrine gift shop, who take a picture with the piece of bread between them. Then Father Dupree, the priest at the shrine, arrives.
"Fascinating," he says,
peering over the edge of his bifocals. By now, the bread has grown stale. The half of the loaf that Mary hasn't cut yet, of course, has a matching picture of Jesus. It strikes me that the thinner you cut the slices, the more incarnations of Jesus you would have.
"The real question isn't that God appeared," Father Dupree tells Mary. "He's always here. It's why he chose to appear now."
Rocco and I are watching this from a distance, leaning on the counter with our arms folded.
"Good Lord," I murmur.
He snorts.
"Exactly. Looks like you baked the Father, the Son, and the Holy Toast."
The door flies open and a reporter with frizzy brown hair enters, trailed by a bear of a cameraman.
"Is this where the Jesus loaf is?"
Mary steps forward.
"Yes. I'm Mary DeAngelis. I own the bakery."
"Great," the reporter says. "I'm Harriet Yarrow from WMUR. We'd like to talk to you and your employees. Last year we did a human interest piece on a logger who saw the Virgin Mary in a tree stump and chained himself to it to keep his company from stripping the rest of that forest. It was the most watched piece of 2012. Are we rolling? Yes? Great." While she interviews Mary and Father Dupree, I hide behind Rocco, who rings up three baguettes, a hot chocolate, and a semolina loaf. Then Harriet sticks her microphone in my face.
"Is this the baker?"
she asks Mary. The camera has a red light above its cyclopean eye, which blinks awake while filming. I stare at it, stricken by the thought of the whole state seeing me on the midday news. I drop my chin to my chest, obliterating my face, even as my cheeks burn with embarrassment. How much has he already filmed? Just a glimpse of my scar before I ducked my head? Or enough to make children drop their spoons in their soup bowls, for their mothers to turn off the television for fear of giving birth to nightmares? "I have to go," I mutter, and I bolt into the bakery office and out the back door. I take the holy stairs two at a time. Everyone comes to the shrine to see the giant rosary, but I like the little grotto at the top of the hill that Mary's planted to look like a Monet painting. It's an area nobody ever visits, which, of course, is exactly how I like it. This is why I'm surprised when I hear footsteps. When Joseph appears, leaning heavily on the railing, I rush over to help him.
"What is going on down there? Is someone famous having coffee?"
"Sort of. Mary thinks she saw the face of Jesus in one of my loaves." I expect him to scoff, but instead Joseph tilts his head, considering this.
"I suppose God tends to show up in places we would not expect."
"You believe in God?" I say, truly surprised. After our conversation about heaven and hell, I had assumed that he was an atheist, too.
"Yes," Joseph replies. "He judges us at the end. The Old Testament God. You must know about this as a Jew."
I feel that pang of isolation, of difference. I never said I was Jewish. Now Joseph looks surprised.
"But your mother
is not me." Emotions chase over his features in quick succession, as if he is wrestling with a dilemma.
The child of a Jewish mother is a Jew.
I suppose it depends on who you're asking, and I'm asking you why it matters.
I did not mean to offend, he says stiffly. I came to ask a favor, and I just needed to be certain you were who I thought you were.
Joseph takes a deep breath, and when he exhales, the words he speaks hang between us.
I would like you to help me die.
What? I say, truly shocked. Why? He is having a senile moment, I think, but Joseph's eyes are bright and focused.
I know this is a surprising request.
Surprising? How about insane?
I have my reasons, Joseph says, stubborn. I ask you to trust me.
I take a step backward. Maybe you should just go.
Please, Joseph begs. It is like you said about chess. I am thinking 5 steps ahead.
His words make me pause. Are you sick?
My doctor says I have the constitution of a much younger man. This is God's joke on me. He makes me so strong that I cannot die even when I want to. I have had cancer, 2 times. I survived a car crash and a broken hip. I have even, God forgive me, swallowed a bottle of pills. But I was found by a Seventh-day Adventist who happened to be passing out leaflets and saw me through the window, lying on the floor.
Why would you try to kill yourself?
Because I should be dead, Sage. It's what I deserve. And you can help me.
He hesitates.
You showed me your scars. I only ask you to let me show you mine.
It strikes me that I know nothing about this man, except for what he has chosen to share with me. And now, apparently, he's picked me to help him carry out his assisted suicide. Look, Joseph, I say gently. You do need help, but not for the reason you think. I don't go around committing murder.
Perhaps not.
He reaches into his coat pocket and pulls out a small photograph, its edges scalloped. He presses it into my palm. In the picture, I see a man, much younger than Joseph, with the same widow's peak, the same hooked nose, a ghosting of his features. He is dressed in the uniform of an SS guard, and he is smiling.
But I did, he says.
Damien held his hand high as his soldiers laughed behind him. I tried to leap to reach the coins, but I couldn't, and stumbled. Although it was only October, there was a hint of winter in the air, and my hands were numb with the cold. Damien's arm snaked around me, a vice pressing me along the length of his body. I could feel the silver buttons of his uniform cutting into my skin. "Let me go," I said through my teeth. "Now, now," he said, grinning. "Is that any way to speak to a paying customer?" It was the last baguette. Once I got his money, I could go back home to my father. I looked around at the other merchants. Old Sal was stirring the dregs of herring left in her barrel. Farouk was folding his silks, studiously avoiding the confrontation. They knew better than to make an enemy of the captain of the guard. "Where are your manners, Anya?" Damien chided. "Please." He tossed a glance at his soldiers. "It sounds good when she begs for me, doesn't it?" Other girls rhapsodized about his striking silver eyes, about whether his hair was as black as night or as black as the wings of a raven, about a smile so full of sorcery it could rob you of your thoughts and speech, but I didn't see the attraction. Damien might have been one of the most eligible men in the village, but he reminded me of the pumpkins left too long on the porch after All Hallows' Eve. Lovely to look at until you touched one and realized it was rotten to the core. Unfortunately, Damien liked a challenge. and since I was the only woman between 10 years and 100 who wasn't swayed by his charm, he had targeted me. He brought down his hand, the one holding the coins, and curled it around my throat. I could feel the silver pressing into the pulse at my neck. He pinned me against the scrub wood of the vegetable seller's cart, as if he wanted to remind me how easy it would be to kill me, how much stronger he was. But then he leaned forward. "Marry me," he whispered, "and you'll never have to worry about taxes again." Still gripping me by the throat, he kissed me. I bit his lip so hard that he bled. As soon as he let go of me, I grabbed the empty basket I used to carry bread back and forth to the market, and I started to run. I wouldn't tell my father, I decided. He had enough to worry about. The further I got into the woods, the more I could smell the peat burning in the fireplace of our cottage. In moments, I would be back home, and my father would hand me the special roll that he had baked for me. I would sit at the counter and tell him about the characters in the village, the mother who became frantic when her twins hid beneath Farouk's bolts of silk, fat Teddy, who insisted on sampling the cheese at each market stall, filled his belly in the process, and never bought a single item. I would tell him about the man I had never seen before, who had come to the market with a teenaged boy who looked to be his brother. But the boy was feeble-minded. He wore a leather helmet that covered his nose and mouth, leaving only holes for breathing, and a leather cuff around his wrist so that his older brother could keep him close by holding tight to a leash. The man strode past my bread stand and the vegetable seller and the other sundries, intent on reaching the meat stall where he asked for a rack of ribs. When he didn't have enough coins to pay, he shrugged out of his woolen coat. "Take this," he said. "It's all I have." As he shivered back across the square, his brother grabbed for the wrapped parcel of meat. "You can have it soon," he promised. And then I lost sight of him. My father would make up a story for them. "They jumped off a circus train and wound up here. They were assassins scoping out Baruch Beiler's mansion." I would laugh and eat my roll, warming myself in front of the fire while my father mixed the next batch of dough. There was a stream that separated the cottage from the house, and my father had placed a wide plank across it so that we could get from one side to the other. But today, when I reached it, I bent to drink, to wash away the bitter taste of Damien that was still on my lips. The water ran red. I set down the basket I was carrying and followed the bank upstream, my boots sinking into the spongy marsh. And then I saw it. The man was lying on his back, the bottom half of his body submerged in the water. His throat and chest had been torn open. His veins were tributaries. His arteries mapped a place I never wanted to go. I started to scream. There was blood. So much blood that it painted his face and stained his hair. There was blood. So much blood that several moments passed before I recognized my father.
Sage. In the picture, the soldier is laughing, as if someone has just told him a joke. His left leg is braced on a crate, and he is holding a pistol in his right hand. Behind him is a barracks. It reminds me of photos I have seen of soldiers on the eve of being shipped out, wearing too much bravado like a cloying aftershave. This is not the face of someone ambivalent about his role. This is someone who enjoyed what he was doing. There are no other people in the picture, but outside the white borders they hover like ghosts, all the prisoners who knew better than to make themselves visible when a Nazi soldier was near. This man in the photo has pale hair and strong shoulders and an air of confidence. It is hard for me to reconcile this man with the one who told me once that he had lost too many people to count. Then again, why would he lie about something like this? You lie to convince people you are not a monster, not that you are one. For that matter, if Joseph is telling the truth, why would he have made himself such a visible member of the community, teaching, coaching, walking around in broad daylight? So, you see, Joseph says, taking the picture from me again, I was SS Totenkopfverbände. I don't believe you, I say. Joseph looks at me, surprised. Why would I confess to you that I did horrible things if it were not true? I don't know, I reply. You tell me. Because you are a Jew. I close my eyes, trying to wade through the whirlpool of wild thoughts in my head. I'm not a Jew. I haven't considered myself one in years, even if Joseph believes that to be a technicality. But if I'm not a Jew, why do I feel so viscerally and personally offended by this photograph of him in an SS uniform? And why does it make me sick to hear him label me, to think that after all this time, Joseph would still feel that one Jew is interchangeable for another? In that moment, a tide of disgust rises inside me. In that moment, I think I could kill him. There is a reason God has kept me alive for this long. He wants me to feel what they felt. They prayed for their lives, but had no control over them. I pray for my death, but have no control over it. This is why I want you to help me. Did you ask any Jews what they wanted? An eye for an eye, one life for many. I'm not going to kill you, Joseph, I say, pushing away from him, but his voice stops me. Please. It's a dying man's wish, he begs, or perhaps the wish of a man who wants to die. They are not so different. He's delusional. He thinks he's some kind of vampire, like the king in his chess set, who is trapped here by his sins. He thinks that if I kill him, biblical justice will be served and a karmic debt will be erased, a Jew taking the life of the man who took the life of other Jews. Logically, I know that's not true. Emotionally, I don't even want to give him the satisfaction of thinking I would consider it. But I can't just walk away and pretend this conversation never happened. If a man came up to me on the street and confessed to a murder, I wouldn't ignore it. I'd find someone who knew what to do. Just because that murder occurred nearly 70 years ago doesn't make it any different. It is still a complete disconnect for me, looking at this photo of an SS officer and trying to figure out how he became the man standing in front of me, the one who has hidden, in plain sight, for more than half a century. I had laughed with Joseph. I had confided in Joseph. I had played chess with Joseph. Behind him is Mary's Monet garden, the one with dahlias and sweet peas and stem roses, hydrangea and delphinium and monk's hood. I think about what she told me weeks ago, how sometimes the most beautiful things can be poisonous. 2 years ago, the John Demjanjuk case was in the news. Although I hadn't followed it, I remember the image of a very old man being removed from his home in a wheelchair. Clearly someone, somewhere, is still out there prosecuting former Nazis. But who? If Joseph is lying, I need to know why. But if Joseph is telling the truth, then I have unwittingly just become a part of history. I need time to think, and I need him to believe I'm on his side. I turn back and hand him the photograph. I think about young Joseph in his uniform, lifting his gun and shooting at someone. I think about a picture in my high school history book, an emaciated Jewish man carrying the body of another. Before I decide whether or not to help you, I have to know what you did, I say slowly. Joseph lets out a breath he has been holding. So it is not a no, he says cautiously. This is good. This is not good, I correct, and I run down the holy stairs, leaving him to fend for himself. I walk. For hours. I know that Joseph will come down from the shrine and try to find me in the bakery, and when he does, I don't want to be there. By the time I get back to the shop, all heaven has broken loose.
A trickle of the frail, the elderly, the wheelchair-bound snakes out the front door. A small knot of nuns kneeling in prayer have gathered by the oleander bush in the restroom hallway. Somehow, in the short time I've been gone, the word about the Jesus loaf has gotten out. Mary stands beside Rocco, who has pulled his dreadlocks into a neat ponytail, and who is holding the bread on a platter covered with a burgundy tea towel. In front of them is a mother pushing her 20-something son in a complicated motorized wheelchair. "Look, Keith," she says, lifting the loaf and holding it against his curled fist. "Can you touch him?" Seeing me, Mary signals Rocco to take over. Then she slips her arm through mine and leads me into the kitchen. Her cheeks are glowing. Her dark hair has been brushed to a high sheen. And holy cow, is she wearing makeup? "Where have you been?" she chides. "You've missed all the excitement." That's what she thinks. Oh? 10 minutes after the midday news aired, they started coming. The old, the sick, anyone who wants to just touch the bread. I think about the petri dish that the loaf must be now, if that many hands have been all over it. "Maybe this is a stupid question," I say. "But why?" "To be healed," Mary replies. Right. Because all this time the CDC should have been looking for the cure for cancer in a slice of bread. "Tell that to the scientists who discovered penicillin," Mary says. "Mary, what if it has nothing to do with a miracle? What if it's just the way the gluten happened to string together?" "I don't believe that. But anyway, it would still be a miracle," Mary says, "because it gives desperate people some hope." My mind unravels back to Joseph, to the Jews in the camp. When you are singled out for torture because of your faith, can religion still be a beacon? Did the woman whose son had profound disabilities believe in the God of this stupid loaf who could help him, or the God who had let him be born that way in the first place? "You should be thrilled. Everyone who's come through here to see the loaf has taken away something else you've baked," Mary says. "You're right," I mutter. "I'm just really tired." "Then go home." Mary looks at her watch. "Since I think tomorrow we'll have twice as many customers." But as I leave the bakery, passing someone who's filming an encounter with the loaf on a flip video camera, I already know I'm going to find a sub to take over my shift. Adam and I have an unwritten agreement to not show up at each other's place of business. You never know who's going to be passing by, who's going to recognize your car. Plus, his boss happens to be Shannon's father. As I park my car a block away from the funeral home, for this very reason, I think again about Joseph. Had a new acquaintance ever waggled a finger at him, genially saying, "I know you from somewhere," and made him break out in a sweat? Did he look in every window not to see his own reflection, but to make sure no one was watching him? And of course, it makes me wonder whether our connection was pure chance, or if he'd been hunting for someone like me. Not just a girl descended from a Jewish family in a town with precious few Jews, but one with the added bonus of a damaged face, too self-conscious to draw attention to herself by going public with his story. I had never told Joseph about Adam, but had he still recognized in me a guilty conscience like his own? Luckily, there isn't a funeral going on. Adam's business is a steady one. He'll always have clients. But if he were in the middle of a service, I wouldn't be rude enough to disturb him. I text Adam when I am hovering outside the back of the building, near the recycling bins and the dumpster. "I'm out back. Need to talk." A moment later, he appears, dressed like a surgeon. "What are you doing here, Sage?" he whispers, although we are alone. "Robert's upstairs." Robert, the father-in-law. "I'm having a really bad day," I say, close to tears. "And I'm having a really long one. Can't this wait?" "Please," I beg. "5 minutes?" Before he can reply, a tall man with silver hair appears in the doorway beside him.
"Maybe you'd like to tell me, Adam, why the embalming room door is wide open with a client on the table? I thought you kicked the cigarette habit."
Spying me, he registers the Picasso half of my face and forces a smile.
"I'm sorry. May I help you?"
"Dad," Adam says, "this is Sage." "McPhee," I jump in, turning slightly so that my scar is better hidden. "I'm a reporter for the Maine Express." I realize too late that sounds like a train, not a newspaper. "I'm doing a story about a day in the life of a mortician," I say. Adam and I both watch Robert scrutinize me. I'm still wearing my baking outfit, loose t-shirt, baggy shorts, Crocs. I'm sure no self-respecting reporter would be caught dead at an interview looking like this. "She called me last week to arrange a time to shadow me," Adam lies. Robert nods.
"Of course, Ms. McPhee, I'm happy to answer any questions that Adam can't."
Adam visibly relaxes. "Why don't you follow me?" He puts his hand on my arm, steering me into the facility. There is a shock as his hand touches my bare skin. When he leads me down the hall, I shiver. It's cold in the basement of the funeral home. Adam enters a room on the right and closes the door behind us. On the table is an elderly woman, naked beneath a sheet.
"Adam," I say, swallowing. "Is she?"
"Well, she's not taking a nap," he says, laughing. "Come on, Sage, you know what I do for a living."
"I didn't plan on watching you do it."
"You're the one who came up with the reporter angle. You could have told him you were a cop and that you needed to take me down to the station."
It smells like death in here, and frost, and antiseptic. I want to fold myself into Adam's arms, but there is a window in the door, and at any moment, Robert or someone else could walk by. He hesitates.
"Maybe you could just look the other way? Because I sort of have to get to work, especially in this heat."
I nod and stare at the wall. I hear Adam sorting through metallic instruments, and then something buzzes to life. I'm holding Joseph's story like an acorn tucked away. I don't want to share it yet, but I don't want it to take root, either. At first I think Adam must be using a saw, but then I peek from the corner of my eye and realize he is shaving the dead woman.
"Why are you doing that?"
The electric blade growls as he rounds her chin.
"Everyone gets shaved, even kids. Peach fuzz makes the makeup more noticeable, and you want that memory picture, the last image you have of a loved one, to be natural."
I am fascinated by his economy of movement, by his efficiency. This is a part of his life I know so little about, and I'm hungry for any tidbit of him I can take away. "When does the embalming happen?" He looks up, surprised by my interest.
"After we shape the face. Once the fluid enters the veins, the body firms up."
Adam slips a piece of cotton between the left eye and the eyelid, and then sets a small plastic cap on top, like a giant contact lens.
"Why are you here, Sage? It's not because you have a burning desire to be a mortician. What happened to you today?"
"Do people ever tell you things you wish they wouldn't?" I blurt out.
"Most of the people I meet can't talk anymore."
I watch Adam thread a suture string onto a curved needle.
"But their relatives give me an earful. Usually they say what they should have said to their loved one before she died."
He slips the needle through the jaw below the gums and threads it through the upper jaw into a nostril.
"I guess I'm the last stop, you know. The repository of regret."
Adam smiles.
"Sounds like a goth band, doesn't it?"
The needle passes through the septum into the other nostril and back into the mouth.
"What brought this on?" he asks.
"I had a conversation with someone today that really rattled me.
I'm not sure what I should do about it.
Maybe he doesn't want you to do anything. Maybe he just needed you to listen.
But it isn't that simple.
The confessions Adam hears from the relatives of the deceased are should-haves and wish-ides, not I-dids. Once you are given a grenade with the pin pulled out, you have to act. You have to pass it off to someone who knows how to disable it, or press it back into the hands of the person who's relinquished it. Because if you don't, you're bound to explode. Adam gently ties the sutures so that the mouth cannot drop open, but looks naturally set. I imagine Joseph dying, his mouth being sewn shut, all his secrets trapped inside. On the way to the police station, I call Rubina Finetto. She's a 76-year-old Italian woman who retired in Westerbrook. Although she doesn't have the stamina to be a baker full-time anymore, I've called her once or twice to fill in for me when I was down for the count with the flu. I tell her which preferments to use, where my spreadsheets are with the baker's percentage that will yield enough output to keep Mary from firing me. I tell her to tell Mary I'll be a little late. I haven't been to the police station since my bike was stolen when I was a senior in high school. My mother took me in to file a report. I remember that at the same time, the father of one of the most popular girls in school was being brought in, disheveled and reeking of alcohol at 4 p.m. He was the head of a local insurance company, and they were one of the few families in town who could afford an in-ground pool. It was the first time I remember learning that people are never who they seem to be. The dispatcher at the little glass window has a nose ring and a buzz cut, which is maybe why she doesn't blink twice when I approach. Can I help you? How do you just come out and say, "I think my friend is a Nazi," without sounding insane? I was hoping to talk to a detective, I say. About? It's complicated. She blinks. Try me. I have information about a crime that was committed. She hesitates, as if weighing whether or not I'm telling the truth. Then she writes down my name. Take a seat. There's a row of chairs, but instead of sitting, I stand and read the names of the deadbeat dads who fill the wanted posters on a giant bulletin board. A flyer advertises a class for fire safety. Ms. Singer? I turn around to see a tall man with cropped gray hair and skin the color of one of Rocco's mocha lattes. He's wearing a gun holstered on his belt and a badge around his neck. I'm Detective Vix, he says, staring just a beat too long at my face. Would you mind coming inside? He punches in a key code and opens a door, leading me down a narrow hallway to a conference room. Take a seat. Can I get you a cup of coffee? I'm all set, I tell him. Even though I know I'm not being interrogated, when he closes the door behind me, I feel trapped. Heat rushes up my neck, and I break out in a sweat. What if the detective thinks I'm lying? What if he starts asking me too many questions? Maybe I shouldn't get involved. I don't really know anything about Joseph's past, and even if he is telling the truth, what could possibly be done after almost 70 years? And yet, when my grandma was being taken by the Nazis, how many other Germans had turned a blind eye, making the same kinds of excuses? So, Detective Vic says, what's this about? I take a deep breath. A man I know may be a Nazi. The detective purses his lips. A neo-Nazi? No, the kind from World War II. How old is this guy? Vic asks. I don't know exactly, in his 90s. The right age, anyway, for the math to make sense. And what is it that led you to believe he's a Nazi? He showed me a photograph of himself in uniform. Do you know that it was authentic? You think I'm making this up? I say, so surprised that I meet the detective's gaze head on. Why would I do that?
Why would 1,000 crazy people call into a tip line that runs on the news about a missing kid?
Vic says, shrugging.
Far be it from me to figure out the human psyche.
Stung, I feel my scar burn. I'm telling you the truth. I am just leaving out, conveniently, the fact that this same man asked me to kill him. And that I chose to let him believe I was entertaining the possibility.
Vix tilts his head, and I can see that he's already making a judgment, not about Joseph, but about me. Clearly, I'm trying my damnedest to hide my face. He must be wondering if there's more I'm concealing.
Is there anything in this man's behavior that would indicate he was actually involved in Nazi activities?
He doesn't wear a swastika on his forehead, if that's what you're asking, I say. But he has a German accent. In fact, he used to teach the language at the high school.
Hang on. Are you talking about Joseph Weber?
Vic says.
He goes to my church, sings in the choir. He led the 4th of July parade last year as the Citizen of the Year. I've never even seen the guy swat a mosquito.
Maybe he likes bugs more than he likes Jews, I say flatly.
Vix leans back in his chair. Miss Singer, did Mr. Weber say something that upset you personally?
Yes, I say. He told me he was a Nazi.
I mean an argument, a misunderstanding, maybe even an offhand comment about your appearance. Something that might have warranted such an accusation.
We're friends. That's why he confided in me in the first place.
That may be, Miss Singer, but we're not in the habit of arresting someone for alleged crimes without having a valid reason to believe he might be a person of interest. Yes, the guy speaks with a German accent, and he's old. But I've never even experienced a whiff of racial or religious prejudice from him.
Isn't that the point? I thought serial killers were supposed to be totally charming in public. That's why nobody guesses they're serial killers. You're just going to assume I'm crazy? You're not even going to investigate what he did?
What did he do?
I look down at the table. I don't know exactly. That's why I'm here. I thought you could help me find out.
Vix looks at me for a long moment. Why don't you write down your contact information, Ms. Singer?
He suggests, passing me a piece of paper and a pen.
I'll look into things, and we'll be in touch.
Without a word, I scribble down my information. Why would anyone believe me, Sage Singer, a damaged ghost who only comes out at night, especially when Joseph has spent the past 22 years gilding his reputation as a beloved Westerbrook community member and humanitarian? I hand the paper back to Detective Vix. I know you're not going to contact me, I say coolly. I know you're going to toss that piece of paper into the trash as soon as I walk out the door. But it's not like I walked in here saying I found a UFO in my backyard. The Holocaust happened. Nazis existed. And they didn't all just evaporate into thin air when the war ended.
Which was nearly 70 years ago,
Detective Vix points out. I thought there was no statute of limitations on murder, I say, and I walk out of the conference room. My Nana only serves tea in a glass. For as long as I can remember, she has said this is the only way to drink it properly, the way her parents used to serve it when she was a young girl. It strikes me as I sit at her kitchen table, watching her bustle around the kitchen with her cane to set the kettle and arrange arugula on a plate, that although she talks openly and easily about being a child and about her life with my grandfather, there is a caesura in the timeline of her life, a break of years, a derailment.
This is some surprise, Nana says. A nice one, but still a surprise.
I was in the area, I lie. How couldn't I stop by? My grandmother sets the plate on the table. She is tiny, 5 feet, maybe, although I used to think of her as tall. She always wore the most beautiful set of pearls, which my grandfather had given her as a wedding gift, and in the old photo of the ceremony that sat on her mantle, she looked like a movie star with her dark hair in victory rolls and slim figure hugged by a confection of lace and satin. She and my grandfather used to run an antiquarian bookstore, a tiny hole in the wall that had narrow aisles jammed with hundreds of old tomes. My mother, who would always buy her books new, hated the vintage hardcovers with their cracked spines and threadbare cloth covers. True, you couldn't go in there and find the latest bestseller, but when you held one of those volumes in your hands, you were leafing through another person's life. Someone else had once loved that story, too. Someone else had carried that book in a backpack, devoured it over breakfast, mopped up that coffee stain at a Paris cafe, cried herself to sleep after that last chapter. The scent of their store was distinctive, a slight damp mildew, a pinch of dust. To me, it was the smell of history. My grandfather had been an editor at a small academic press before buying the bookstore. My grandmother had allegedly wanted to be a writer, although in my childhood I never saw her write anything longer than a letter. But she loved stories. That much was true. She would sit me on the glass counter beside the cash register and take the A.A. Milne and the J.M. Barrie books from their locked case and show me the illustrations. When I was older, she would let me wrap customers' purchases in the brown butcher paper she kept on a giant roll, and she taught me to tie it with string, just like she did. Eventually, my grandparents sold the bookstore to a developer who was bulldozing a host of mom-and-pop stores to make way for a Target. Whatever money they made was enough for my Nana to live on, even all these years after Papa was gone.
"You were not really in the area," she says now. "You look just like your father used to look when he lied to me."
I laugh.
"How's that?" "Like you've swallowed a lemon. Once, when your father was maybe 5, he stole my nail polish remover. When I asked him about it, he lied. Eventually, I found it in his sock drawer and told him so. He became hysterical. Turned out, he read the label and thought it would make me, someone Polish, disappear. He hid it before it could do its job."
Nana smiles.
"I loved that boy."
She sighs.
"No mother should outlive a child."
"It's no party to outlive your parents, either," I reply. For a moment, there is a shadow veiling her features. Then she leans down and hugs me.
"See? Now you are not lying. I know you're here because you're lonely, Sage. That's nothing to be ashamed of. Maybe now we will have each other."
They are the same words, I realize, that Joseph said to me.
"You should cut your hair," my Nana announces. "No one can see you properly."
A small snort escapes me. I think I'd rather run naked through the street than cut my hair and leave my face exposed.
"That's the point," I say.
She tilts her head.
"I wonder what magic could make you see yourself the way the rest of us do," she muses. "Maybe then you'd stop living like a monster who comes out only after dark."
"I'm a baker. I have to work at night."
"Do you? Or did you pick the profession because of the hours?"
Nana asks. "I didn't come here to be grilled about my career choice."
"Of course not."
She reaches over and pats my face, the bad side. She lets her thumb linger on the ridged flesh to let me know that it doesn't bother her, and that it shouldn't bother me.
"And your sisters?"
"I haven't talked to them lately," I mutter. That is an understatement. I actively avoid their calls.
"You know they love you, Sage,"
my grandmother says, and I shrug. There is nothing she could possibly say that can convince me Pepper and Saffron don't hold me responsible for the fact that our mother isn't alive. A timer goes off on the oven, and my grandmother pulls out a braid of challah. She may have given up formal religion, but she still adheres to the culture of Judaism. There is no ailment her matzo ball soup cannot fix. There is no Friday she doesn't have fresh bread. Daisy, the home health aide Nana refers to as her girl, is the one who mixes the dough in the KitchenAid and sets it to rise before Nana braids it. It took 2 years for Nana to trust Daisy enough to give her the family recipe, the same one I use at our daily bread. "Smells good," I say, desperate to change the course of the conversation. My grandmother drops the first challah down on the counter and goes back, in turn, for each of the other three.
"You know what I think," she says. "I think that even when I do not remember my own name anymore, I will still know how to make this challah. My father, he made sure of it. He used to quiz me when I walked into our apartment after school, when I was studying with a friend, when we were strolling together in the city center. Minka, he'd say, how much honey? How many eggs? He'd ask what temperature the water should be at, but that was a trick question.
Warm to dissolve the yeast, boiling to mix the wet ingredients, cold to balance it out. My grandmother looks over her shoulder and nods.
My father, he would have been very happy to know his challah is in good hands.
This, I realize, is my opportunity. I wait until Nana has brought one of the braids to the table on a cutting board. As she slices it with a bread knife, steam rises like a passing soul. Why didn't you and Papa start a bakery instead of a bookstore? She laughs.
Your papa couldn't boil water, much less a bagel. To bake bread, you have to have a gift, like my father did, like you do.
You hardly ever talk about your parents, I say. Her hand trembles the slightest bit where she holds the knife, so slightly that had I not been watching so carefully, I might never have noticed.
What's there to say? She shrugs. You know this. My mother, she kept house, and my father was a baker in Łódź. You know this.
What happened to them, Nana?
They died a long time ago, she says dismissively.
She hands me a piece of bread, no butter, because if you've made a truly great challah, you don't need any.
Ah, look at this. It could have risen more. My father used to say that a good loaf you can eat tomorrow, but a bad loaf you should eat now.
I grasp her hand. The skin is like tissue, the bones pronounced. What happened to